Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 11, Discourse Number 4.
The first question. Bhagwan, there is something that even you cannot do. You can't put an Italian in an Irish joke. It is against the dharma. Dharma chetana. It is true, I goofed again. Go on reminding me. These goddamn jokes are dangerous. And I love the Italians so much that wherever I can find a place for them, I try to manage. Sometimes I succeed. Sometimes I fail. But you caught me. To put the record right, the joke is, two gentlemen are sitting in a garden, one British, one Irish. The British gentleman asked the Irish, "If you were not Irish, what would you be?" The Irish says, "Of course, I would be British." And then he asks the British, "If you were not British, what you would be?" And the British said, "I would be ashamed." But I got mixed up. That's why I have all my jokes typed with me. That one was not typed with me. About God and about truth and about religion, there is no trouble. I know them by my personal experience. But these jokes, yes, Chetana, it is against the dharma. And I hope it is not going to happen again. The second question. Bhagwan, why cannot I see my own faults while I am immensely capable of seeing others' smallest ones too? Pragita, it is very normal. It is not something exceptional. Our eyes are focused on others. We are other-oriented. We only see the others. It is not only a question of faults. We never see ourselves. Even if we want to see ourselves, we have to look in a mirror. We have to create the image When the image is there, the other has appeared. The mirror helps us to see ourselves because it creates the other. Otherwise, we are absolutely extroverts. We have forgotten the language how to look in. Hence, as a consequence of it, you cannot see your own faults. Nobody can see. The moment you start seeing your faults, they start dropping like dry leaves. Then nothing else has to be done. To see them is enough. Just to be aware of your faults is all that is needed. In that awareness, they start disappearing, they evaporate. One can go on committing a certain error only if he remains unconscious of it. Unconsciousness is a must to go on committing the same errors. Even if you try to change, you will commit the same error in some other form, in some other shape, and they come in all sizes and all shapes. You will exchange, you will substitute, but you cannot drop it, because deep down you don't see that it is a fault. Others may be telling you, because they can see. That's why everybody thinks himself so beautiful, so intelligent, so virtuous, so saintly, and nobody agrees with him. The reason is simple. You look at others, you see their reality, and about yourself you carry fictions, beautiful fictions. About yourself you are very fictitious. All that you know about yourself is more or less a myth. It has nothing to do with reality. The moment one sees one's faults, a radical change sets in. Hence, all the Buddhas down the ages have been teaching only one thing: awareness. They don't teach you character. Character is taught by priests, politicians, but not by the Buddhas. Buddhas teach you consciousness, not conscience. Conscience is a trick played upon you by others. Others are telling you what is right and what is wrong. They are forcing their ideas upon you. And they go on forcing from the very childhood, when you were so innocent, so vulnerable, so delicate, that there was a possibility to make any impression on you, any imprint on you. They have conditioned you from the very beginning. That conditioning is called conscience. And that conscience goes on dominating your whole life. Conscience is a strategy of the society to enslave you. Buddhas teach consciousness. Consciousness means you are not to learn from others what is right and what is wrong. There is no need to learn from anybody. You have simply to go in. Just the inward journey is enough. The deeper you go, the more consciousness is released. When you reach at the center, you are so full of light that darkness disappears. When you bring light in your room, you don't have to push the darkness out of the room. The presence of the light is enough, because darkness is only an absence of light. So are all our insanities, madnesses. But everybody can see others' faults. So don't be worried, Pragita, about it. This is the situation in which everybody is living. A man dressed as Adolf Hitler visited a psychiatrist. "You can see I have no problems," he said. "I have the greatest army in the world, all the money I will ever need, and every conceivable luxury you can imagine." "Then what seems to be your problem?" asked the doctor. "It is my wife," said the man. "She thinks she is Mrs. Weaver." Don't laugh at the poor man. It is nobody else than you. A man went into a tailor's shop and saw a man hanging by one arm from the center of the ceiling. "What is he doing there?" he asked the tailor. "Ah, pay no attention," said the tailor. "He thinks he is a light bulb." "Well, why don't you tell him he is not?" asked the startled customer. "What?" replied the tailor. "And work in the dark?" The moment you know you are mad, you are no more mad. That's the only criterion of sanity. The moment you know you are ignorant, you have become wise. The oracle at Delphi declared Socrates as the most wise man on the earth. Few people rushed to Socrates and they told him, "Be pleased, rejoice. The oracle at Delphi has declared you the wisest man in the world." Socrates said, "That is all nonsense. I know only one thing, that I know nothing." The people were puzzled and confused. They went back to the temple. They told the oracle that you say that Socrates is the wisest man in the world, but he himself denies it. On the contrary, he says he is utterly ignorant. He says he knows only one thing, that he knows nothing. And the oracle laughed and he said, "That's why I have declared him the most wise man of the world. The greatest wise man of the world. That's why precisely because he knows that he is ignorant. Ignorant people believe they are wise. Insane people believe they are the sanest. Yes, Pragita, it happens. It is part of human nature that we go on looking on the outside. We watch everybody except ourselves. Hence we know more about others than about ourselves. We know nothing about ourselves. We are not a witness to our own functioning of the mind. We are not watchful inside. You need a 180-degree turn. That's what meditation is all about. You have to close your eyes and start watching. In the beginning you will find only darkness and nothing else. And many people become frightened and rush out because on the outside there is light. Yes, there is light on the outside. But that light is not going to enlighten you. That light is not going to help you at all. You need inner light, a light which has its source in your very being, a light which cannot be extinguished even by death. A light which is eternal. And you have it. The potential is there. You are born with it. But you are keeping it at your back. You never look at it. And because for centuries, for many lives, you have looked outside, it has become a mechanical habit. Even when you are asleep, you are looking at dreams. Dreams mean reflections of the outside. When you close your eyes, you start again daydreaming or thinking. That means again you become interested into others. This has become such a chronic habit that there are not even small intervals, small windows into your own being from where you can have a glimpse of who you are. In the beginning it is a hard struggle, it is arduous, it is difficult, but not impossible. If you are decisive, if you are committed to inner exploration, then sooner or later it happens. Just you have to go on digging. You have to go on struggling with the darkness. Soon you will pass the darkness and you will enter in the realm of light. And that light is true light, far more truer than the light of the sun or the moon. Because all the lights that are on the outside are temporal. They are only for the time being. Even the sun is going one day to die. Not only small lamps die in the morning, they exhaust their resources. Even the sun with such an immense resource is dying every day, sooner or later it will become a black hole. It will die, and there will not come any light from it. Howsoever long it lives, but it is not eternal. The inner light is eternal. It has no beginning, no end. It is synonymous with God. And I am not interested in telling you to drop your faults to make yourself good, to improve your character. No, not at all. I am not interested in your character at all. I am interested only in your consciousness. Become more alert, more conscious. Just go deeper and deeper into you till you find your center of being. You are living on the periphery. And on the periphery, there is always turmoil. Deeper you go, deeper silence prevails. And in those experiences of silence, light, joy, your life starts moving into a different dimension. The errors, the mistakes start disappearing. So don't be worried about the errors and the mistakes and the faults. Be concerned about a single thing, a single phenomenon. Put your total energy onto one goal, and that is how to be more conscious, how to be more awakened. If you put your total energy to it, it is going to happen. It is inevitable. It is your birthright. Third question. Bhagwan, what do you mean by calling Sarjano a big mouth? Nirmal, exactly that. A big mouth. I will tell you a fictitious story. I was going to the Himalayas. Radha was accompanying me. The train was stopped in the middle of the night in the jungle, and the whole train was robbed. The robbers came to our compartment also. I told them, don't disturb us, take whatever you want. So they carried the two suitcases. I was worried about Radha. That she may get very much frightened, may become very much concerned about her things. But I was surprised when they left, she started laughing, ha ha, ha ha. I said, what is the matter, Radha? What's the matter? She said, I have befooled them. I have saved your $50,000 diamond watch. I have said my Rolex. I have said my earrings. I have said my golden diamond ring. And all the valuables. I said, how did you manage? He said, I kept all of them into my mouth. I said, that makes me feel even very much more sad. She said, why? I said, if we had brought Sarjana with us, he would have saved the two suitcases. Next time we come to the Himalayas, never forget, Sarjana has to accompany us. The fourth question, Bhagwan, does it mean the same to wear a mala or a cross? Jan, it does not mean the same. They are polar opposites. The people who have become interested in the cross are pathological. They are not interested in Christ. They are interested in the cross. If they were really interested in Christ, they would have been also interested in Buddha, in Lao Tzu, in Krishna, in Kabir. But they are not interested in Christ. They are interested in the cross. Hence I don't call Christianity Christianity. I call it Christianity. If Jesus was not crucified, there would have been no such thing as you find all over the world in the name of Christianity. These people became interested in death. This interest is morbid. They became interested in worshipping death. Jesus is secondary. Cross became primary. Because he is crucified, because he has suffered, he has caught their attention. There are people who are always interested in suffering, in misery, in death. My interest is not death. My interest is life. I love life unconditionally. I celebrate death too, just because it is part of life, not as death, but as part of life, as the finishing touch, as the crescendo, as the ultimate flowering of life. If you have lived rightly, your death is a beautiful phenomenon. But my interest basically, intrinsically, is life. The mala represents life. The cross represents death. The mala represents a certain art of making life a garland. The beads are the moments. Each bead has to be perfect. Each moment has to be lived in its perfection. And there is a thread running behind, which is invisible, passing through each bead. That thread is of eternity. Each moment is threaded with eternity. Unless your life knows what eternity is, your life will be just a heap of beads or a heap of flowers, but it will not be a garland, it will not be a mala. It will not have any inner harmony. The beads will remain unrelated. It will be a chaos. It will not be a cosmos. There will be no order, no discipline. But the discipline should be invisible like the threads. And how one comes to know the eternity? The only way to know the thread is to go inside the beads. There, at the very center of the bead, you will find the thread passing. Going deep into each moment, going totally into it, you will find eternity. Each moment is part of an eternal procession, of an eternal celebration. The mala represents time as beads, visible, and the thread as eternity, the invisible. There are 108 beads in the mala. 108 beads represent 108 methods of meditation. All the methods of meditation can be reduced to 108. 108 methods are the fundamental methods of meditation. Then they can have thousands with little differences, little changes, joining two methods or three methods or few parts of one method and few parts of another method. One can make as many methods as possible, but the fundamental methods are 108. The mala has 108 beads. And a locket with a picture of somebody. Nobody knows who he is. Somebody anonymous. Somebody who is more a nobody than a somebody. A man who has died long before as a separate entity, who does not exist anymore as an I, but is only an open space. That is where you have to reach. That is where you have to arrive. That's your ultimate hope. The mala is not a cross. Christianity worships death. And that's where it has gone wrong. It has lost the joy of life, the laughter, the humor. It has lost contact with Jesus. It goes on worshipping the crucified Jesus, but it is not capable of worshipping the alive Jesus. And my effort here is to help you to worship life, to live so joyously, with such humor, that your life becomes a dance. I don't want you to become sad and serious. Sincere, of course, but serious never. I would like you to go deeper into existence. Dance with the flowers. Have dialogues with the stars. Look into people's eyes and love, and don't hold back. The only unspiritual people are those who are holding back, who are living in a miserly way, who are living only partially, fragmentarily, who are not integrated. And don't live an accidental life. Let there be a thread running. The Sanskrit word for thread is sutra. That's why these great saints of Buddha, Patanjali, Krishna, Mahavira are called sutras. These are the threads. If you understand them, your life will not remain just a heap, accidental heap. You will not be just a driftwood at the mercy of unconscious forces. Your life will become a conscious movement Your life will become an arch. It will have a sense of direction. And each act will be connected with every other act of your life. You will not be accidental. If you are accidental, you will be only a noise. If you are not accidental, you can become music. The mala represents music. It represents harmony. It represents that you have found the sutra, the thread that makes your life one whole, one piece. Life is beautiful when it is one piece. Life is ugly when it is fragmented. When you are just a crowd, and when the crowd is always fighting within yourself, when there is always a civil war, of course, the cross has influenced humanity very much, because millions of people find meaning in the cross because it fits with their life. Their life are almost on the cross. They are living in agony. They have never tasted what ecstasy is. It is not an accident that Krishna's message has not reached millions. Just the other day I was telling you, Zarathustra has not reached millions. For the simple reason, because he loved life. Jesus has reached millions, not because of himself, but because of an accident in his life. It is because of the Jews and the Romans. If they had not crucified him, if they have tolerated him, he would have died by himself, and then nobody would have heard anything about him. All these churches and thousands of monks and nuns, you would not have seen at all. They gathered around the cross. The cross became significant because it synchronizes with something in their life. Their life is of suffering, and the cross represents it. They are also on the cross. Their whole life is agony. Their whole life is hell. What I am saying is not going to appeal to many people. It is going to appeal to only few intelligent ones, courageous ones, to only few who are really healthy and whole. This is unfortunate, but this has been so up to now. Whenever somebody comes here to teach life to you, he seems far away. There seems to be no dialogue happening between him and you. He talks about dance, and you don't know even how to walk. He talks about ecstasy. And you don't know what that word means. One of my sannyasins has just come from Greece. She has informed me that in Greece, ecstasis means bus stop. That seems to be more meaningful. And in a sense, it is a bus stop. In fact, the terminus, the last stop, beyond that, there is no way to go. The last bus stop. You hear the word ecstasy, the sound comes to you, but the meaning is missed. But when you hear the word suffering, it is not only the sound that comes to you, you know the meaning. When you know what cross is, you perfectly agree, your life agrees with it. But your life is wrong. Your life is not yet life. You are not yet born. That's why Jesus goes on saying again and again, unless you are born again, my whole effort here is to give you a rebirth. The mala is not a cross. The fifth question, Bhagwan, why are the journalists always writing against you? Sudarshan, feel happy that they are always writing. Don't be worried about what they write. If they are writing, that means something is happening here. And they can only write against. Because when you write something in favor, you have to experience what is happening here. Without experiencing it, you cannot write a favorable report about it. You have to be here for a few months. They come only for one day. They look around. They see the meditators, but by seeing the meditators, you can't see meditation. They see that something is happening, and something so new for them that it does not fit with their idea of an ashram, of a monastery. Hence, naturally, they turn against, they become antagonistic. If they are Hindus, they are bound to be absolutely against. For the simple reason that this is not a Hindu ashrama. It does not fit with their idea of an ashram. The Hindu ashram has to be very dull and dead. And here, there is so much dance and so much song and so much joy and so much love. they are socked. And things are so intense here. And for centuries they have created a certain ideal of the Hindu ashrama. People should not be active there. Inaction is worshipped. People should renounce life. And here we rejoice life. How they can write in favor? To them it appears I am destroying their whole ideal. To them it seems for centuries they have worshipped a certain ideal and I am sabotaging it. And in a way they are right. I want to sabotage that stupid idea of an ashram, that it should be dead, people should be inactive, people should be dull, uncreative, against life, against love, against everything that smells of joy. They should be walking corpses. And the Hindu idea of sannyas is that one should become a sannyasin only after 75 years. That means in India nobody can become a sannyasin. The average age is 36. So as far as average man is concerned, there seems to be no possibility of anybody ever becoming a sannyasi. 75 years, then sannyas, the fourth stage of life, when death starts knocking on your doors, when one foot is already in the grave, then you should become a sannyasi. And here they see young people, so young, they cannot believe their eyes. Why these people have become sannyasins? This is not the time for sannyas. I am trying to create a totally new concept of sannyas. Because they are against life, of course. If you are against life, 75 years seems to be the right time. Because life has already left you, now you can renounce. At least you can enjoy the idea that you are renouncing life. Life has already left you. What is the point of renunciation now? What you are renouncing, the whole idea is stupid. Then why not take sannyas when you are dead? Just wait few days more, maybe 1 week. Why be in such a hurry? Just a little more. In India, when a man dies, they cover him with orange clothes. I don't know whom they are deceiving. The dead body is being covered with the clothes of a sannyasi. And they chant the name of God when they are taking the dead body to cremate it. Now I don't know who is hearing their chanting. That poor fellow is no more there. They are simply deceiving themselves. Hindus are bound to be against. Jainas come here, they are bound to be against. This is not a Jaina ashram. In fact, Jainas have always been against ashramas. There is no such thing as a Jaina ashram. They want their sannyasins to be wanderers. They are very much afraid that if a person stays in one place, he may become attached to the place, to the house, to the people surrounding him. And they are so much afraid of life that it is better keep moving. The Jaina monk has to stay not more than 3 days at one place. 4th day he has to leave. So no attachments, no friendships, no love affairs. Are possible. At the most, he becomes acquainted. In 3 days, you cannot have intimacies with people. One day you come. Only, in fact, one day you remain in the village. The 3rd day, you are preparing to leave. This is fear of life. And to me, a sannyasin should be fearless. So when a Jaina comes here, looking so many people, living together with such joy, with such love, with deep involvement with each other, with great intimacies, friendships, love affairs, much more love is happening in these 6 acres than it may be happening on all over the world. In fact, sometimes I wonder how much love 6 acres can contain. It seems the capacity to contain love is infinite. And anybody who comes, if a Christian comes, he can't find the idea of his monastery. There are Christian monasteries where women are not allowed. For 1,000 years, no woman has ever entered. Not even a small baby, a 2-month-old baby, is allowed. What kind of people are living inside? Monks are monsters. They are afraid of a 2-month-old baby. What that poor 2-month-old baby can do to them? They are afraid of themselves. They may do something. They are violent. And they are doing all kinds of perversions. They become perverted if people are not allowed to be natural. Their energies go perverse. All sexual perversions came out of the monasteries. Remember it. They all have religious origins. They are very much spiritual and holy. All sexual perversions have their sources somewhere in religion. Now, only monks are living in a monastery. How long you think they can avoid homosexuality? Only nuns are living in a monastery. How long they can avoid lesbianism? Impossible. It is natural. Something is bound to happen. So when they come here, they are somebody. It is very difficult to find a journalist who has no prejudices of his own. He comes with his prejudices. And this place is totally new. So naturally they are offended, outraged. And my statements are outrageous. They are meant to be. They are electric shocks to these people. They get very much disturbed and they take revenge. And remember one thing, if you report something good, it never becomes news. Nobody is interested in good things. People are interested in something bad, something sensational. So they are in search for sensation, and you can find enough sensational things here than you can find anywhere else. You need not invent. We provide. Father Murphy was a priest in a very poor parish. He asked for suggestions on a way that he could raise money for his church, and was told that horse owners always had money. He went to a horse auction, but he made a very poor buyer, as the horse turned out to be a donkey. However, he thought he might enter the donkey in a race. The donkey came in third, and the next morning the headlines in the paper read, "Father Murphy's ass shows." The archbishop saw the paper and was very angry. The next day the donkey came in first, and the headlines read, "Father Murphy's ass out front." The archbishop was up in arms and figured something had to be done. Father Murphy had entered the donkey for a third time, and it came in second. Now the newspaper read, "Father Murphy's ass back in place." The archbishop thought this was finally too much, so he forbade the priest to enter the donkey the next day, which inspired the editor to write the headline, "Archbishop scratches Father Murphy's ass." Finally, the archbishop heard this and ordered Father Murphy to get rid of the donkey, but he was unable to sell it, so he gave it to Sister Agatha for a pet. When the archbishop heard this, he ordered Sister Agatha to dispose of the animal at once. She sold it for $10. Next day the headlines read, "Sister Agatha peddles her ass for $10. Don't be worried about the journalists. Enjoy whatsoever they write, and help them to find things so they can go on writing. I am much more concerned right now that they should go on writing, because whether they write for or against, they bring more and more people to me. And once a person comes here, it is very difficult to escape. So I am just absolutely grateful to the journalists, whatsoever they are doing. They are doing such humanitarian work, such great service to me. So when they come here, don't feel antagonistic. help them in every possible way. The sixth question. Bhagwan, I am sitting silently, doing nothing, and the weeds are growing all around me. Roderick, weeds are divine. Don't call them weeds. They are as much spiritual as the Buddhas. They partake of God as much as roses. Remove the man from the earth. Will there be any difference between weeds and roses? All these distinctions are made up by the mind. You are not really sitting silently. Otherwise, who is telling you weeds are growing? Your mind is still functioning, whispering things to you. It is your mind. If you are really silent, there is no mind. Then whether weeds grow or roses grow, it is all the same to you. What difference is there? Can't you enjoy weeds? They are beautiful people. See the weeds swaying, dancing in the wind, in the sun. What do you think is lurking in them, which roses have? Nothing is lurking. This is just an idea. And ideas change. It is possible one day roses may go out of fashion. Weeds may become an in thing. Hundred years before, nobody had ever thought that cactuses will be loved by people. But now, cactus is in and the rose is out. To talk about the rose looks old-fashioned, looks orthodox, conventional. To talk about cactuses is avant-garde. It shows that you are modern, contemporary. People are keeping cactuses in their bedrooms. Dangerous cactuses, poisonous cactuses, who can kill you. But they have come in fashion. And once something comes in fashion, there are so many fools who start appreciating them. People simply go on following whatsoever is made fashionable by a few clever and cunning people. Just 100 years before, nobody would have liked Picasso's paintings. And now, Picasso is the greatest artist, not only of this century, but of the whole history. What has happened? Just the fashion has changed. People get tired of one thing. They go on moving to the opposite extreme. Roderick, there is nothing wrong in weeds. There is nothing wrong in anything. The idea of right and wrong means the mind is there. You are not sitting silently and you are not sitting doing nothing. You are discriminating, and that is action. And you are labeling, and that is thinking. And you are judging. Drop all judgment, all labeling, all discrimination, and just watch weeds growing. So what? Let them grow. When you don't have a mind at all, you are also a weed. So weeds growing around you, it is not something strange. Weeds surrounding a weed. And why? Once a Zen master was asked by the emperor, because the master was a great painter, that the king wanted a bamboo to be painted. The master said it will take time. How much? The king said. The master said, that is difficult to say, but at least 2-3 years. The king said, are you mad or something? You are one of the greatest painters. I was thinking you can just dry it right now. He said, that is not the problem. Drying a bamboo is not the problem. But first I have to be a bamboo. Otherwise, how I do know what a bamboo is? I want to know the bamboo from the inside. So I will have to go and live in a bamboo grove. Now one never knows how long it will take. Unless I know the bamboo from the within, I cannot paint. That has been my practice whole life. I paint only that which I have known from its deepest core. The king said, okay, I will wait. 1 year passed. He sent few people to see what is happening, whether the man is alive or dead. They came and they said, the man is alive, but we don't think that he is a man anymore. He is a bamboo. He was swaying with the bamboos in the wind. We passed by his side, he didn't take any notes. We said, hello. He didn't hear. We wanted to ask him. We looked at his eyes. They were so empty that we became frightened. Either he has gone mad or something has happened. And and he can do anything. So we escaped. He may kill us. Who knows? He may jump upon us. He is no more the same man. The king himself went to see, and the master was swaying in the wind, in the sun. And the king asked, "Sir, what about my painting?" He didn't answer. After 3 years, he appeared in the court. And he said, "Now bring the canvas and the paints, I'm ready." "And why you people were disturbing me again and again?" "If you had not disturbed me, I would have come a little earlier. These fools of your court, they were telling things to me, they were saying, hello. Do you say hello to a bamboo? They disturbed the whole thing. It took months for me again to resettle into being a bamboo and to forget that I am a man. And then you came and you said, 'Sir, is that a way to address a bamboo? When you are going to paint, have anybody heard that bamboos paint? You are a fool. You are surrounded by fools. I had told you that I will come whenever I am ready. The canvas was brought, the brushes and the color, and within seconds he drew the bamboo. And it is said that the king wept out of joy. He had never seen such a painting. It was so alive. It was no ordinary painting. It was not from the outside. It was from the bamboo, as if a bamboo has sprouted on the canvas, not painted." Roderick sits silently, doing nothing, and let things happen, whatsoever is happening. If weeds are growing, let them grow. They have the right to grow as much as you have the right to grow. And if you allow everything without any judgment, if you are non-judgmental, you will grow to such pinnacles of joy and benediction that you cannot imagine right now. Seventh question, Bhagwan, it is terrible what you say about Italians. True, of course, but terrible. Adi, I know it is terrible, but what can I do? I love the Italians. And I want to talk about them as much as I can. They are beautiful people. I hate only when I love. You should be worried about those whom I am not hitting. For example, I have not hit yet the Dutch. I am waiting. When I have gathered enough love for them, I am going to hit them too. It is my way of sowing love and savoring love. Why don't Italians believe in reincarnation? Well, look at it this way. Who would want to come back to life as an Italian? A woman with a baby in her arms was sitting in the waiting room at a railway station in Italy, sobbing bitterly. Up came a porter and asked her what the trouble was. "Ah, dear me," she cried, "some people were in here and they were so rude to me about my son. I am all upset. They said he was so ugly." "There, there, now, love," said the porter soothingly, "don't worry about it. I tell you what, how about a nice cup of tea?" "You are very kind," she said, wiping her eyes. "That would be very nice. And while I am at it," he said, "how about a banana for your monkey?" An Italian with a 1 foot man sitting on his shoulder walked into a bar and ordered a scotch and soda. The bartender was stunned but delivered the drink as ordered. Just as the fellow was about to drink it, the little man knocked it out of his hand. He ordered another one, and again the little man knocked the drink onto the floor. This scene was repeated 3 times. Finally, the bartender could stand it no longer. "What is going on here?" he asked. "It is a long story," the Italian said. "But many years ago, I was in Egypt and found a magic lamp. I rubbed it, and a genie offered me 3 wishes. First I wished for $10 million, then I wished for everlasting life." "Sounds great," said the bartender. "What was your 3rd wish? "I wished for a prick 12 inches long." "Get it?" "Remember it. Sometimes if you come across a genie, never ask for the 3rd wish. Look in the dictionary to find out the real meaning of the prick." The last question, Bhagwan, I feel shocked when you use the word fuck. What to do? Sargamo, it is one of the most beautiful words. English language should be proud of it. I don't think any other language has any such beautiful word. One Tom from California has done a great research on it. I think he must be the famous Tom, Tom, Dick, Harry fame. He says one of the most interesting words in English language today is the word fuck. It is one magical word. Just by its sound, it can describe pain, pleasure, hate and love. In language, it falls into many grammatical categories. It can be used as a verb, both transitive
John fucked Mary, and intransitive, Mary was fucked by John, and as a noun, Mary is a fine fuck. It can be used as an adjective. Mary is fucking beautiful. As you can see, there are not many words with the versatility of fuck. Besides the sexual meaning, there are also the following uses. Fraud. I got fucked at the used car lot. Ignorance. Fucked if I know. Trouble. I guess I am fucked now. Aggression. Fuck you. Displeasure. What the fuck is going on here? Difficulty. I can't understand this fucking job. Incompetence. He is a fuck off. Suspicion. What the fuck are you doing? Enjoyment. I had a fucking time. Request. Get the fuck out of here. Hostility. I am going to knock your fucking head off. Greeting. How the fuck are you? Apathy. Who gives a fuck? Innovation. Get a bigger fucking hammer. Surprise. Fuck, you scared the shit out of me. Anxiety. Today is really fucked. And it is very healthy too. If every morning you do it as a transcendental meditation, just when you get up, the first thing, repeat the mantra, fuck you 5 times. It clears the throat. That's how I keep my throat clear. Enough for today.